This week on Making Contact.
In the richest country on earth, it is absurd that millions of Americans have to make the choice between putting a roof over their heads or feeding their families.
We used to think that, you know, we'll just live in our apartment and while we save to get a house, but I can't even see that, you know, not right now, not today anyway.
Nowhere in the United States can a full-time minimum wage worker afford to rent a two-bedroom apartment. This is the conclusion for the fourth year in a row of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. In fact, a worker would have to earn almost three times the minimum wage to make ends meet. In some metropolitan areas, that figure is much higher. On this edition of Making Contact, we take a look at what many are calling an affordable housing crisis in the United States. I'm Philip Babich, your host this week on Making Contact, an international radio program seeking to create connections between people, vital ideas, and important information. In mid-September 2002, the National Low-Income Housing Coalition released its annual report on the state of affordable housing in the United States. Aptly titled Out of Reach, the coalition's findings demonstrate that there's a growing gap between the wages of low-income workers and the cost of housing. On average, a full-time worker in the United States has to earn $14.66 an hour to afford a two-bedroom apartment and other basic needs. The national minimum wage is $5.15 an hour. At a press conference in Washington, D.C., announcing the release of Out of Reach, Sheila Crowley, president of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, said she regretted not having more upbeat news.
Out of Reach is not very complicated. We take readily available data and compile and present them such that we are able to demonstrate in a rather straightforward manner the depth and breadth of the affordable housing crisis in every jurisdiction in the country. We put in quite accessible, quantifiable terms what every low-wage worker in America knows from personal experience: the cost of modest, decent housing is out of his or her reach. Each year, when we actually run the numbers, weight them, and then aggregate them up to the state and national level, I am impatient to see the results. This year, like last year, and the year before, and the year before that, the results are the same, only worse. Rents are out of reach for the lowest income families, and they are farther out of reach than ever before. The national housing wage is $14.66 an hour. That is a 5% increase over the 2001 national housing wage. In 38 states and the District of Columbia, where 90% of all renter households in the United States reside, the housing wage is over twice the prevailing minimum wage. And in 9 states in the district, it is over 3 times the prevailing minimum wage. I look forward to the day when I can stand here and tell you that there has been a decrease in the housing wage, but today is not that day.
What the coalition has termed the housing wage has become a useful tool for some members of Congress who are advocating for ways to make housing more affordable for low-income workers. That number is as high as $37.31 an hour in San Francisco, which tops the list of least affordable metropolitan areas in the Out of Reach report. Senator Paul Sarbanes of Maryland, who joined Sheila Crowley and others at the press conference, notes that government-sponsored findings by the Millennial Housing Commission match those of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition.
These numbers translate into startling realities for too many families around the country. Hardworking families playing by the rules find that they can't provide really an acceptable housing level for their family. People double up, triple up, crowding too many people into too little space. They live in substandard housing, or they have to forego other necessities. You know, they choose between rent and food. They choose between rent and medicine. It's not a choice one should have to make. And it affects every part of a family's life. Actually, the Millennial Housing Commission, and we hope to be able to use the report of that housing commission in order to move forward on a housing agenda. But the Millennial Housing Commission found, and I quote this, "Decent, affordable, and stable housing promotes family stability and creates a positive environment for raising children. Out of Reach reemphasizes the need for greater housing opportunities for Americans. We've made significant strides, as the report shows, but much, much more needs to be done. It won't be easy. It's going to take a significant time and effort. on many fronts. We need to, I think, to address the affordable housing crisis in three ways. We need to produce new affordable housing. So we need a production program. We need to preserve existing affordable housing, and we need to monitor that very closely. We're concerned about some of the actions that HUD is taking on the in the area of preserving existing affordable housing. And we need to increase home ownership opportunities for low-income families.
As affordable housing grows more scarce, many people are making tough choices, such as relocating far from their jobs, living in substandard housing in crime-ridden areas, or falling further into debt to pay high rents. Miko Johnson, Oscar Navarro, Betty Young, and Jacqueline Knight are four such people struggling to survive. And on top of trying to keep a decent roof over their heads, they're all organizing in their communities, advocating for the right to affordable housing. Making Contact's Amy Pomerleau spoke with them.
After paying the rent, basically, you know, you have a couple hundred bucks left, and it's like, okay, which is going to be the lucky bill that gets paid? You know, will it be PG&E or will it be, you know, another utility or something? And so my debts are still there and just getting higher and higher because I have no money to pay them.
How did Mika Johnson find herself in this situation, paying $1,200 a month, more than 58% of her and her husband's salary, towards rent? On top of that, they pay $700 a month for their children's daycare. Johnson and her family live in the San Francisco area, where the affordable housing market is extremely tight. In 1999, she and her husband, young parents with their first child, were evicted from their Oakland, California apartment, no reason given. They were paying under $700 a month, but after being evicted, they couldn't find a two-bedroom apartment for less than $900. Nowhere to go, they lived with a relative.
The three of us piled in one bed and one room for like 6 months, and it was just hard. It was really hard.
Finally, the Johnsons found another apartment, again in Oakland. Things were looking up. She had another baby and re-entered the workforce 4 months later.
And I had the job exactly 5 days. And we came home from work one afternoon, and there on the door was posted a 30-day notice. And, you know, it was just so unbelievable to me. I was like, okay, this must be because she didn't receive the rent, you know, the rent check or whatever. I know the Postal Service, you know, is a little slow sometimes, so this won't be a problem. You know, I have a receipt, you know, I'll just call her and explain. And she was like, no, that I received it. You know, thank you very much. But, you know, I want you to move. And I'm like, you know, we've been here for 18 months. You know, my son is getting settled in school. Please don't do this. You know, we're very involved in the community. We like where we're living now. Please don't evict us. And she just would not budge, you know. And I was, so why? I asked her, I'm like, why are we being evicted? And she said, well, you know, in the eyes of the law, I'm not obligated to give you a reason to evict you. All I have to do is give you a 30-day notice. And I was shocked. I didn't realize until that point that landlords did not have to give you a reason to evict you.
In Oakland, tenants have no protection against eviction, even if the rent's paid on time. When she was evicted, rents were rising, and Johnson says she thinks the landlord wanted to cash in. Again, without a place of their own, the family moved in with her mother in San Francisco for 6 months.
All we really took was, like, the beds, you know, the baby bed, my oldest son's bed, and our bed, and a dresser, and some dishes, some toys. You know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Johnson worried about the impact another move would have on her son, who liked his school. To give him some stability, she kept him in his old school in Oakland while they were staying in San Francisco. This meant she had to get him up at 5:30 in the morning to get him to school by 7:30. Johnson's story is not unique. Millions of people are struggling to find housing they can afford, and often they pay much more than one-third of their income on rent. That's the general yardstick used in federal housing policy to gauge the affordability of housing in a given area, taking into account other costs of living, such as food, utilities, and childcare. On the East Coast in Jersey City, New Jersey, Jacqueline Knight had to quit her job as a school traffic guard and aide at a school for the disabled because she wasn't able to find housing near her work. She had to move to the suburbs.
Commuting wouldn't have been feasible when you got to use public transportation. So that was kind of rough because now I'm searching for a job. But on the other hand, at least my rent is not sky high.
As a single parent of four boys, keeping a roof over her family's head is her top concern. She needed three bedrooms and could only afford $1,200 with the help of a Section 8 voucher. This government program allows her to pay one-third of her income in rent, with the voucher covering the rest. But Section 8 wasn't always a help.
Either people were asking for too much that Section 8 or affordable housing couldn't provide. And with the limitations, you just don't want to choose anywhere. And then we have so much crime and so much stuff that was going on in Jersey City that if you did find a place, it might have wouldn't have been the best area.
Knight says while a lot of new housing is being constructed in Jersey City, not enough is set aside for affordable housing.
Because they were dealing with the New York community, they figured if they encouraged and make it appealing to New Yorkers, they can charge an arm and a leg because, New York folks are used to paying a lot. So to them, Jersey City would be little to nothing compared to the rent they were paying, especially like Manhattan. Well, a lot of people moved over from other areas, and they were willing to pay over $1,700 and over a month. So that kind of like meant that the people who lived in the community, like me, who was born and raised there, it made it kind of difficult for us to be able to pay like $1,700 a month.
Even with a moderate income, finding decent and affordable housing is difficult.
We've been here for 5 years, And at all this time, we've been dreaming about having our own house.
Oscar Navarro is a quality control inspector working for a cable contract company in the Oakland, California area. While he's only been paying $675 a month to rent a two-bedroom house, it's not in a secure neighborhood. His kids have to play indoors unless he or his wife are free to supervise them.
Because there's a lot of cars speeding. There's a lot of strange people coming into our neighborhood. There is no security police around this area. It's really hard to find. When you call them, they don't show up on time. They take too long to answer calls, or they take too long to show up to the places.
Navarro has a good-paying job, making $45,000 to $54,000 a year. But in his quest to buy a house, he's faced several obstacles. One, for example, was that he needed a credit history, paying up to 11% interest on a truck he bought. And while building up his credit history, the housing prices kept on rising. So by the time he had established credit, it wasn't enough to buy a house. But his dream finally came true. In September 2002, Navarro signed the papers and now owns a house in Modesto.
So getting this house will be like a relief for me. I will know that my family is safer, and I will know that they will be able to have a backyard where they can play and that they don't need to be inside the house all the time like they used to, and that's my dream.
But he has to commute as much as 2 hours each way from work to his home in Modesto, the closest location he could afford. Taking on a long commute is just one of the difficult choices low to moderate income families are making. Betty Young is a program secretary at a nonprofit organization in Richfield, Minnesota. She makes $27,000 a year and pays $685 a month in rent.
I'm paying for a high-priced loan.
She'd move, but she says it's hard to find a decent place to live. She says her choice is to pay over $1,100 or share with a roommate, not an option too appealing to Young, who's in her late 50s. Other obstacles are credit checks, where a landlord can charge you $25 to $50 each time you simply apply for an apartment. Already dealing with substandard conditions, tenants in Young's building complain to management about security problems, leaks in the roof, and mold-infested apartments. When there was a big construction project in the area, rodents raided the apartment building. You could hear mice in the walls, Young said.
Management remedy for that is that we should buy steel wool and stick it in the holes. And at first they were saying buy glue traps. They were telling the tenants to buy the glue traps. And we felt that, you know, I mean, we didn't bring them in here, so why should we have to buy glue traps?
So she and other tenants organized and went to the city for help.
When we went to the mayor's office, we got 200 names of tenants who put in a complaint about repairs that need to be done in their apartment. And the guy from the city seemed to think that wasn't a big deal to him. He felt like we should have had more names. Well, whether it was 2 or 200, you would think that they would want to know what's going on. But it just seems like your voice is not being heard. And you have to do more than just talk to these people because it doesn't seem to do any good. And a lot of people are just, you know, they get so mad you don't know which way to turn. You don't know who to talk to, and especially when it comes to politicians. But we figure this is an election year. Maybe we'll get heard. Somebody will hear us.
Young's not the only one organizing. On top of the intense pressures of trying to find a home, Jacqueline Knight, Oscar Navarro, as well as Betty Young, are active members of ACORN, a national community organization which focuses on housing and tenants' rights. Amika Johnson, whose family was evicted twice, is the community organizer for a November 2002 ballot measure in Oakland, which aims to prevent landlords from evicting tenants indiscriminately. Johnson hopes Measure EE will protect tenants from landlords chasing after rising rents. Meanwhile, she and her husband are still looking for housing they can afford. She's worried that they'll be evicted again, but this time for cause, because they can't keep up with their current rent.
We used to think that, you know, we'll just live in our apartment while we save to get a house, but I can't even see that. I can't even see that, you know, not right now, not today anyway. But, you know, hopefully we'll be in that situation again where we'll be somewhere where we can afford to live there and stay there until we can, you know, save some money and buy a house and, you know, and just live and enjoy our children.
For Making Contact, I'm Amy Pomerleau.
You are listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you want more information about the subject of this week's program, or if you would like to get in touch with any of our guests, please give us a call. It's toll-free, 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts. That's 800-529-5736. You can also check out our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. As we mentioned earlier, the shortage of affordable housing is not just limited to metropolitan areas. Moises Losa is executive director of the Housing Assistance Council, which contributed to the Out of Reach report. The council has been helping local organizations build affordable homes in rural areas of the United States since 1971. Losa says that economic growth in depressed or rural areas doesn't always provide a solution to an affordable housing crisis. In fact, in some cases, he says, the situation could worsen.
For example, Washington County in the far southwestern corner of Utah on the Arizona border has had rapid population growth since the 1970s, due largely to retirees moving in from other places. We did research and found that the county's economy is growing and will continue to grow, primarily in the service sector. At the same time, the majority of new homes being built or single-family for-sale homes at prices beyond the reach of the service sector workers. Similarly, when a federal prison was built in Fremont County in central Colorado, housing demand increased as construction workers and prison employees arrived from other locations. Rents more than doubled, and home sales prices shot up. So many of the newcomers settled in adjacent counties. They had lower housing costs. They could afford housing in adjacent counties, but they had long commutes. Even in relatively inexpensive rural areas, like the non-metropolitan parts of West Virginia and Mississippi, a worker earning minimum wage would have to work over 60 hours to afford the fair market rent for a two-bedroom apartment. West Virginia and Mississippi are in two of the most persistently poor parts of the country. Persistent poverty regions with high poverty rates from at least 1950 to now are primarily rural. Besides Appalachia and the Mississippi Delta region, they include the U.S.-Mexico border region, Native American lands, and out of reach shows that even in these depressed areas, housing costs too much. When decent, affordable housing is not available, rural Americans have no good choices. They have to commute long distances to get to their jobs. They may rent places they can afford that are in substandard condition. They may double up with others, leading to stress and health problems because of the overcrowding. Or in the worst cases, they may become homeless.
There's argument that all you need to achieve the quality of life in America is a strong private sector economy is dead wrong.
Congressman Barney Frank of Massachusetts is the ranking member of the Housing and Community Opportunity Subcommittee of the House Financial Services Committee.
Of course, a strong private sector economy is a good thing. Of course, reducing unemployment is a good thing. And of course, the kind of leverage that lower wage workers get when the employment market is tighter so they can get better conditions, those are all good things. It's a good thing for us to produce more goods and services. But not only does that not automatically deal with social problems, in some cases it makes them worse, and housing is a classic example of market failure, because it is precisely the prosperity of the 90s that was very significant but not universally spread that exacerbated the housing problem. This issue is worse rather than better for many, many people because the prosperity of the 90s in many parts of this country drove up housing prices and did not give people comparable increases in income. So there just can be no argument about the need for there to be public sector intervention.
There's some movement in Congress to do just that. Congressman Bernie Sanders of Vermont has drafted legislation to establish a national housing trust fund. Sanders says he believes that if there's enough political will to solve the affordable housing crisis in the United States, there's money in the federal budget to do it.
All of you know that Congress thought that it had enough money to provide $500 billion in tax breaks to the wealthiest 1% of the population. We have enough money to provide $218 billion over a six-year period for the Highway Trust Fund, and we have enough money to provide $58 billion over a three-year period into the Aviation Trust Fund. Given those realities, we should have enough money to put $27 billion over a seven-year period into a national affordable housing trust fund.
Sanders' bill has almost 200 co-sponsors. Congressman Barney Frank says the idea of a national housing trust fund has picked up momentum in the House of Representatives.
They are afraid, the Republican leadership, that if the housing bill comes up, that when Bernie once again offers the amendment embodying a long-term commitment to housing, it might win. It might mean that some of those co-sponsors might actually have to vote for the bill they've been taking credit for co-sponsoring, and they don't want that to happen. So we are now in a situation where this bill has been ready to go to the floor for a significant amount of time. They are afraid to bring it up. What's happened is that the public has now understood the message we are getting across. And the problem, of course, is that they have given away in tax cuts to the wealthy the money that was needed. They cut taxes in 2001, and then came the need to fight a war in Afghanistan, and then came the need for Homeland Security, and now comes a commitment on their part to spend $100 or $200 billion in Iraq. Hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars have been added to the federal expenditure side, totally unforeseen when they passed the tax cut, and they don't think there's any problem there. So they must have found some source of money other than simply printing it, which I thought they were opposed to pay for this. Unfortunately, none of the money from that tree, in their judgment, is to go to housing. And indeed, the fact that they have other purposes to which they want to put an already overstretched revenue base is another reason why they are fighting the housing bill so hard.
Meanwhile, the lack of affordable housing is having some very real consequences for children in low-income families. President of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, Sheila Crowley, says that studies show children whose families need to move frequently to find affordable housing do worse in school than students in more stable housing situations. Also, these children tend to have worse health.
There was a very interesting study done in Boston comparing children who were in housing receiving housing assistance and children on the waiting list for housing assistance on a whole range of health indicators. And the children on the waiting list fared much worse than the children who were actually in assisted housing. And that had to do with both the quality of housing that they were in, as well as the family's ability to provide for other basic necessities that was impaired when they did not have housing assistance. And then finally, there's been research done in Philadelphia of looking at factors that contribute to infant mortality amongst extremely poor women. And when they do the analysis of a whole range of factors, the one that in fact has statistical significance is housing stability or instability. And the more transient a woman is during her pregnancy and during the first year of her child's life, there's a much higher incidence of infant mortality than if the family is has a stable place to live. And that factor overrides all other factors that we would typically associate with infant mortality, behavioral factors related to what the mother is doing.
Crowley adds that the housing market has failed to provide the opportunity for what many consider a fundamental value and right, housing stability.
Establishing and maintaining a home of one's own is one of the key developmental tasks in American life. Living independently is a cherished value. Housing stability is the foundation to the success that we expect from one another in all other spheres of our daily lives, in childbearing, in education, in employment, in health, and all of the other things that we hold important. Yet we have a housing market that is increasingly unresponsive to millions of families in our country and public policy that continues to neglect its responsibility to intervene in this housing market. And I think that is the essential message of Out of Reach. Beyond the numbers, it is that it is time for substantial changes in public policy to begin to bring the housing wage down.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact, the state of affordable housing in the United States. Thanks for listening, and special thanks to Robert Fraser for recorded portions. If you'd like more information about the subject of this week's program, or if you'd like to get in touch with any of our guests, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Call that same phone number for tapes and transcripts. That's 800-529-5736. You can also check out our website at radioproject.org. That's radioproject.org. Making Contact is an independent production. We're committed to providing a forum for voices and opinions not often heard in the mass media. If you have suggestions for future programs, we'd love to hear from you. Laura Lovati is our acting executive director, Peggy Law, founding director, Amy Pomerleau, associate producer, Lisa Rudman, women's desk director, Norman Solomon, senior advisor, David Barsamian, national producer, Rosalind Fay, administrative coordinator, Susanna Hines, executive assistant, and I'm your host and managing producer, Philip Babbage. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. Until next time,